G'day everybody, my name is Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer.
And welcome to Tactical Tennis. I was going to say the world's premier tennis podcast, but I don't know if that's true. So it is podcast.
Let's not be the guys that say that.
No, I know. That's why I didn't actually say it.
You tell us if it's
Yeah, welcome to a tennis podcast. Right. So this is a podcast where we talk about tennis tactics, technique, professional players, patterns, all kinds of wild and crazy things related to tennis, and hopefully in the process improve your understanding of the game and your own game a little bit. And so today we're actually, well, first of all, I guess, yeah, we're back. It's been a little while.
Yeah, we're back. We've been away for a little bit. We hardly recorded through the Australian Open. I was gone for a month in Australia. When's the last time that we had an episode actually published?
Well, it was right after Christmas, I believe, and then we actually had recorded on the topic that we're about to speak on, but decided that we wanted to do a better job of it, so here we are.
Yeah, that happens. No pressure today, right?
No pressure. So, yes, we're back after a rather lengthy break, but we have been busy in the meanwhile. Like, Jacob was in Australia for a month. There is actually a new relatively in-depth article up on the website right now about the up-and-coming Australian Alex Deminar. So if you haven't read that yet, please pop on to tacticaltennis.com and check that out. And then probably finish listening to the podcast first, because I imagine a lot of you are listening while you drive. Don't read tennis articles behind the wheel. I do.
Definitely don't read. And you don't think that you have enough time to read it when you're stopped at a light or something, because that's ridiculous.
No, it's a
use
long article.
Use that function on your phone that doesn't let you do that. And just
and,
listen.
The last thing I want is a headline of man dies behind wheel reading tactical tennis article. Anyways, back to the topic at hand today, which is today we're going to talk a little bit about how to get an accurate evaluation of your own game. And by evaluation, what I really mean is an understanding of the relative strengths and weaknesses that you have as a player, which is something that we see people struggling with at both the professional levels all the way down to relatively beginner levels, where people don't actually have a good understanding of the things that they do well on a court and the things they do poorly in a court and how to put all those pieces together. And so this is part of a series that we really want to do, where we talk more about how you can, without really actually changing the technique of your game, which is hard for us to teach you over a podcast, but if you have a better understanding, one thing that we can teach you to do is to think differently about tennis and think differently about how you put a point together. And so this is the beginning of that, which is if you don't understand yourself, then it's very hard to put together a winning game plan with any accuracy, because if you're not evaluating your own game well, then the game plan that you come up with from the stuff that we tell you in future upcoming episodes isn't going to work very well, because you're going to do a bad job of it.
You know, it's funny. I was talking to one of my buddies about the idea for this, saying, you know, we need to just dedicate some time to going over, you know, how you just do a good self-evaluation, how you can really be honest with yourself about where different aspects of your game stand. And his reaction to it was like, oh, what are you talking about? Like, that's so easy. The irony, of course, was that he's completely clueless about his own game.
Sure.
He sees himself in a completely different light. And I told him, honestly, like, look, I made this mistake year after year after year, and I changed. It wasn't like I made the same evaluation every time, but it was that my evaluation consistently wasn't quite living up to the standard that I was aiming for, right?
So what I just heard was that your evaluation was consistently wrong.
It was consistently wrong, but it was consistently wrong in different ways.
The consistency
was that it wasn't accurate, and it wasn't consistently, like, I was wrong in the same direction or in the same sense all the time. I wasn't, like, always inflating or always deflating.
Your perception of your game changed over time, but it remained inaccurate in different ways as your game changed. And that's important. And it is important to understand that even at the professional level, many players don't have a good idea of the real strengths and weaknesses of their own game. And part of this may be to put in a little bit of context. If you think about and just going to take a wild and crazy leap here. If you think about when they've done studies on eyewitness accounts of crimes, for example, people are notoriously terrible at being accurate in identifying, you know, people who committed crimes and recalling the details of crimes, because our perception of reality is colored by a lot of emotional and neurological factors. And so the world that we see is always skewed in some way. And that's really important because I think virtually everybody who plays tennis has an emotional attachment to the game, and very specifically to their game, in some fashion. We like to have an idea of ourselves as players. I still like to think of myself as a serve volleyer, even though I only serve volley.
You haven't done that
sometimes
for years.
In singles. Well, I mean, I'll serve volley every single point in a doubles match, first and second serve. But when I play singles, I'll serve and volley some of the time. But right. There's a part of me where it's still a little bit of a lingering self-identity as a player. We all, you know, maybe somebody might like to think of themselves as the big hitting guy with the huge forehand. And that's all well and good, but what that will tend to do is change the way that we view the outcomes of points, and it'll change the way that we think about how a match is being played. And if I like to think of myself as the big-hitting forehand guy, what I'm likely to do then is actually, in my own mind, over-exaggerate the memories of the winners that I hit with my forehand,
right,
and underrepresent the errors that I made with my forehand to reconfirm that self-identity that I hold. And this is something that we'll see consistently with people, is that they'll inaccurately remember the winners versus errors count for various reasons, and that results in them having a very poor mental representation of their own game.
All right, so this is a really interesting sort of side topic before we get into this. There's psychology, or there's a science to the psychology here, that people think, well, I observe the world and then I think about the world and then I do an analysis and then I use my logic and I come to some conclusion and then I attach emotion to the things that are going on. Realistically, the science tells us that that isn't the order of things, that instead we have an emotional reaction that is the first thing that we feel. And more often than not, we justify our reaction unless we purposefully inhibit those feelings and try to look at them from a different perspective. So when we get into the world of sports, whether, you know, traditionally I've always thought of golf, but this applies just as much to tennis, right? We sort of validate our feelings about things instead of actually doing the work to step back and figure out how we should feel about things.
Sure.
So I want to kind of dive in this. The way that I want to start this conversation is I want to ask you, what do you think the most common misconception, and we're talking about self-misconceptions here, is that I see on the tour, let's say among all the baseliners?
So the most common misconception that you see on the tour that players have about themselves?
Yes.
Oh, goodness. That would have been a good one for you to give me a heads up that you were going to ask me.
But I didn't. And so instead, we're going to catch you live. So you have to just shoot from the hip and tell me what's the first thing that comes to your mind that doesn't sound ridiculous.
My first instinct would be that people would tend to think their forehand is stronger than it is and their backhand is worse than it is.
See, that's what I thought. That's exactly what I thought, right? Because that was my first sort of reaction. What I've actually seen is that players think that their best shot oftentimes is their backhand. Now, you know from watching the tour, it's not that many guys who have a stronger backhand than forehand. So what is it that makes pro players think that their backhand is their better shot when it's not?
I would say that they've probably learned better risk management on the backhand side because it isn't quite as strong and they don't have quite as many options. And so they tend to make less errors off that side, and therefore they're more risk averse. Like, they take less risk off the backhand, and therefore they're a little more They manage it better.
They manage it better. And that's literally, that's what it comes down to. So I can't tell you how many guys that literally have a backhand that they cannot do anything with. Like, guys that haven't hit a winner off their backhand more than two or three times in the last three or four tournaments. I mean, we're talking about shots that do not hurt their opponents, okay? And you can ask 50 players on the tour, and all 50 guys will say, oh, yeah, that guy's backhand is worse than his forehand, right? But the player has the self-conception that his backhand is better because they manage it well and because they don't make errors off of it, even if it gets them into trouble all the time. And occasionally they will make more errors on the forehand, even if they win all their points on the forehand.
Right.
They look at the side where they're losing.
Sure. Well, this brings me back to actually an important idea, because if we're going to teach people how to accurately self-evaluate, it's important to break. What I've noticed is that people tend to fall into one of two categories, okay? Which is, the first category is people who overrepresent their own winners. This is somebody who, for example, might try a forehand down the line and make it for a winner maybe 2 times out of 10. But if you ask them after the match, they would say that they hit a winner on it 6 times out of 10. Right. These are people that take a positive result and then magnify it in their own mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's one pool, what I kind of call the half glass full, or actually in this case, probably they think the glass is completely full when it's only half full. And then the other side, we have people who tend to have a more negative view on things, where they'll over-exaggerate the errors. And this is the type of player who, maybe they have a winning game plan, but they make a couple errors and all of a sudden they'll throw the whole game plan out the window. And you go and talk to them in a changeover, and they're, well, right, it wasn't working. And it's like, well, you made one mistake. We right. don't abandon the game. So if you ask them, they'd say, well, I missed 50 backhands, when the reality is might have been they missed, say, 3. And they over-exaggerate the errors, and they, you know, their mind tends to over-focus on negative outcomes, whereas right. some people tend to over-focus on positive outcomes. And it's exceedingly rare, folks, whether or not you realize it, that you are not going to fall into one of these two categories. I almost guarantee that you will fall into one of these two categories. The important okay. thing is, well, hang on. The important thing is to understand which of the two that it is. Because if you can't do that, then you're going to have a hard time.
Which one do I fall into?
You, I think, are the person who traditionally overrepresented your winners.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've known you a long time now, and I've watched you play a lot of tennis and talked to you about a lot of tennis. And
well, you know, we've never talked about it, so we're doing it, you know, we're talking about it for the first time on a podcast. It was like, gosh, I hope he gets this one, you know.
What could possibly go wrong? Yeah, no, you've always been the type of person who overrepresented the positive. You know, I always remember you thinking how great your backhand was because you could hit some spectacular winners off that side, but also make a lot of errors. But you just will always remember the good shots and forget the bad.
You know, it's funny. People have different justifications for it, right? So for me, my sense that my backhand was better at that time, which was wrong. I mean, we should be clear that my management off the backhand was terrible. Okay? I mean, terrible.
I will contest. I'll affirm that it was pretty bad.
No, I mean, okay, we'll say like it was terrible for the level player that I was, you know, and all the context and all that stuff, right? It's not like I was a completely terrible player, but it was bad. It was subpar in the truest sense of the word. Now, that being said, I felt like, well, my backhand is good because the technique was pretty good, and the technique was actually more stable than the technique on my forehand, which was changing like every 6 months, right? But there's sure. no doubt that I could do more damage with the forehand. I could access more of the court. My management was better, and I was making fewer errors over there. Right?
Yeah, you so made better choices on your forehand.
Absolutely. So, you know, when you look at all those things, you go, man, like, how could you possibly think that your backhand is better if you're doing all these things better on the forehand? And I mean, it's not like I was hitting Marty Fish 100-mile-an-hour line drive winners, you know, even ever, right? Not even one time, much less, you know, enough for that to be justified. So how does a player start the process of sort of figuring this out. I mean, where do we even start? Like, we have an idea of, okay, I see where you're going, you know, maybe we get this wrong, but, you know, surely this isn't me. If you're thinking, surely this isn't you, then you, my sense is you probably haven't done the work, so it probably is you.
No, this is virtually everybody. I mean, almost nobody has a genuinely accurate representation of their own game. I mean, take Roger Federer, for example, who all of a sudden starts hitting backhand winners like it's 1999. You know, the thing about that is, it's not like he didn't have that shot. He just never believed that he had that shot. He had an inaccurate understanding or representation of his own backhand for 15 years on the Pro Tour.
Yeah.
And that's important to recognize, folks. I mean, this is Roger Federer, 20-time Grand Slam winner, didn't have an accurate understanding of how good his own backhand was for 15 years as a professional player. And so if he can get it wrong, then you can too. So understanding that, and understanding that you probably either over-exaggerate your winners and ignore your errors, or over-exaggerate your errors and ignore the positives, now we have to start to say, well, if I know that that's a possibility, how do I get an accurate understanding? And there's a few ways that we can go about this, and some of it comes down to resources, okay? Because not everybody's in a situation where you can easily videotape one of your own matches in reasonably high quality. That's not a tool that's accessible to everybody. So let's start with the cheapest option, okay? And we'll work our way up from there. And the cheapest option is to talk to your friends and the people that you play tennis against. And literally ask them, what do you see as being the shot that I do the most damage with? Where do you think I make the most errors? You know, what's the thing that I do on the court that makes you the most uncomfortable as a player in terms of provides the most challenging situations to you? And where do you feel like you can get me to beat myself? Questions like this, which are obviously a little bit leading questions, can get somebody to hopefully give you an honest answer. Important to note, I wouldn't do this to your, you know, your club rival that absolutely hates your guts, because they might just flat out lie to you to get you to play the wrong type of tennis against them. But realistically, most people that you talk to, well, if you're earnest about this and you come to them with sincerity and you're authentic about it, they're going to sit down and tell you the truth. And it's very rare when I play against somebody else that I don't very quickly get an accurate idea of what they do well and they do poorly, because they're going to hurt me with shots, certain shots, and not going to hurt me with others. And that's very easy. That's very quickly apparent. And I don't have an emotional attachment to their game.
Right.
And that changes my ability to perceive them.
It's really just an observation at that point. There's nothing that's getting caught up with it. It's more of just like repeating back a fact.
Yes, absolutely. And so that's step number one. Step number two is find a friend who actually knows something about tennis, have them watch you play with a notepad and a pencil, and take some statistics. How many first serves do you make? How many second serves do you make? How many forehand winners do you make, you know, down the line across court? How many backhand winners do you hit down the line across court? How many forehand errors do you make down the line across court? How many backhand errors down the line across court? That's a very simple stat pool to make. You know, also maybe how many times when you come to that do you win the point? How many times when you come to that do you lose the point? If you just do that right there, that will give you very quickly a broad overview of understanding where your winners are coming from and where your errors are coming from. Once you know that, you can take steps to dive deeper. But that's a great way to get a basic handle on what's going on. And if you don't have a friend who will do that, the second step that I would recommend you do is go to your local tennis club and pay one of the junior players there like $10 to watch you play, you know, an hour's worth of tennis, and do the same thing. Probably you can find some 15-year-old kid who's actually a pretty good player who'll do that for $10 for an hour in cash, and that way you can get the same tool. And in some ways that might be almost better than having your friend do it, because your friend might be emotionally involved in your tennis to some degree. Whereas some 15-year-old kid, maybe not.
This is one of my favorite exercises. I do love doing this with friends, doing sort of an exchange where it's like, okay, you watch one of my matches and take stats, I watch one of yours and take stats. It's a great way to start to build the understanding of your game, both about yourself, like we're talking about tonight, but also generally. It's pretty interesting to watch other people with that very specific goal in mind. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're, I don't know how many people out here are doing this, but I think if you're teaching kids or teaching clinics or working at a club or anything, this is also a neat little thing to do to get your members more involved, to say, hey, like, you come to this clinic, you spend some money on tennis, you want to get better, you know, grab one of the juniors and, you know, support them a little bit. They can pay for a string job or something and they can help you get better. It's a pretty cool thing if you can get that to be a regular thing that your little, let's call it, tennis community does, right? Yes. Everybody gets better together, and it brings a lot of people together.
Yeah, so if you can't, or I guess say, if you have the resources to do a step up from that, then the next thing you need to do is actually tape one of your own matches. There's a variety of equipment out there that lets you do this. The simplest and probably cheapest way is to get an iPhone mount or a phone mount and get one of the little octopusy, you know, like three-legged bendy tripods and hook it onto a fence. That's the technical name for it. I don't know. You may have a more kind of relaxed, casual moniker for these devices.
No, but I think that's one of the brands.
The octopusy three-legged tripod.
Yep.
That you can bend the legs around, you hook it onto the fence straight behind the court and just record from there. That's probably the cheapest route to go. If you're willing, able, or maybe you already have some of the equipment to do this, doing it with a GoPro is great because you can get the wide-angle lenses and, you know, get 60 frames a second. That's always a nice thing. And then if somebody hits your GoPro with a tennis ball, you don't have to worry about losing a $600 phone. Yep. Always a plus. But then a step up from that, you can get one of those contraptions that hooks up over the top of the back of the fence and gets you a more elevated view. And that could be really great because it gives you a fuller understanding of what's going on in the court, because you could just have better visual angles. It's more similar to the type of angle that you'll see when you watch tennis on television. And you'd use a similar kind of mount, put your phone up there, put a GoPro up there. You know, there's other kind of portable video cameras that are digital that you can use. But once you do that, you can take stats yourself and you can get very in depth with those stats. You can be very not in depth. You can start out just doing kind of the broad strokes like we discussed. One of the ways that I like to map, and I think I've talked about this before in one of the podcasts maybe a year ago, was to actually draw a diagram of a court on a piece of paper and then to mark with symbols where in the court I made contact, or whoever I'm mapping, taking stats on a match for, but where in the court they make contact with the ball when they either hit an error or hit a winner. And so I might use a circle represents a backhand, a triangle represents a forehand. If it's an open circle, as in it's, you know, the inside is blank, then it was an error. And if it's a filled-in circle, then it was a winner. So an open circle is a backhand error. A filled-in circle is a backhand winner. You know, same thing for triangles for forehands or squares for forehands. You know, you can kind of get your own little diagram situation going. But that way, what you can start to do, it's a little more sophisticated than the types of stats we talked about a little bit ago, is it lets you get a better understanding of where in the court these things happen. And that gives you a deeper level of understanding, because maybe, you know, if we take the example of Jake's backhand, you know, I can tell you from personal experience, having watched him hit it for, you know, 15 years now, is that his backhand actually technically back then was a good stroke. It was a good stroke. The problem was that he had absolutely no risk management off that side. He didn't really understand how to use it well in the context of the bigger picture of his game. And so he played it in a very high risk, high reward style. And unfortunately, he was taking a lot of those high risks in situations where the odds were not in his favor. And so what ended up happening was the error rate was very high.
It's funny that you call it high risk. I just call it hitting the wrong shot, because risk implies that there's a good chance that it was going to be made.
Well, no, that is what risk management really comes down to. When I say risk, if the risk is low, there's a good chance it's going to be made. If the risk is high, there's a low chance it's going to be made. Unfortunately, you consistently made high risk choices off the backhand side.
Well, but
the point is that if you had just had a clear understanding of when I hit cross-court backhands. Oh, this is the other part that I probably should have put in there, is also when I'm doing that diagram with the little symbols, I'll put a small arrow in the direction that the ball, I was trying to hit the ball. So a little arrow pointing cross-court or a little arrow pointing down the line. And it's a very small arrow, just enough to give the sense of which direction I was going in. Because then I can also start to understand, look, when I hit a cross-court backhand from 6 feet behind the baseline in my own backhand corner, I don't make a lot of errors. I also don't hit a lot of winners. But when I go down the line, my error count is really high. Whereas when I hit the down-the-line backhand from 6 feet inside the baseline, my winner count goes up and my error count, relatively speaking, goes down. And so then you can start to understand it's not the stroke itself, it's what I'm trying to do with it. And that's huge, folks, because again, when you talk about professional players, these folks don't have perfect technique. There are very few genuinely complete strokes at the professional level. I mean, I can really think of a handful of them off the top of my head going back through the last, 20 years of tennis.
Okay, well, let me interrupt you right there, because this is, I think, is a really, really important thing to understand. I mean, I come out of a heavy, heavy biomechanics and movement background. And one of the ways that I think of what makes a pro tennis player now, and in some sense really a pro athlete in many different sports, is not, it's not the result of having perfect techniques like I thought it was.
No.
When I was younger, right? But it's more about, like I ask myself this question, or I ask other people this question, right? Like, what allows one person to be a pro athlete and not another? And oftentimes, the vast majority of times, the answer is that they are able to achieve an outcome with something that is so far from perfect. Okay? So, sure. Like, I was just watching earlier tonight, Taylor Fritz just upset Sam Querrey at the Delray Beach Open. And Taylor is a guy who has, like, so far from perfect technique. But he's remarkable in the fact that he can hit an absolutely smashing ball when it looks like he should barely even be able to get the ball over the net. Like, if I use that technique, I'm hitting the ball 40 miles an hour. Taylor's hitting it 87 miles an hour at the same stroke.
Sure.
Well, guess what, folks? If you can do stuff like that, then what's standing in your way of being a pro?
Decisions.
Right. So not that many things, right? Things that he can control more than you can control, how tall are you, how fast were you, like what kind of genetics were you born with and all this kind of stuff. But he can drill, he can learn, he can hire coaches. Easier things to sort of address in some sense. So the idea that we want to improve our technique, I'm never going to argue. I'm a huge guy that it's important to have stable technique. It's important to understand what your body can do and what it can't do. But when you talk about making good decisions and being the best tennis player you can, there's always a balance to strike between trying to improve technical aspects and understanding what you can do and what you can't do and playing the best that you can on any given day.
Right. Well, so this is the idea of playing in a fashion that's optimal for the tools that you have at your disposal.
Yes. And ideally, you would be able to blend those so that you can play in a way that is good for you today and avoids hindering your development in the future. And like that's something that I didn't do well. I played in a style that allowed me to develop but did not help me win matches at the moment, at the time.
Right. And there's, in a lot of ways, those two things do not at all have to be mutually exclusive.
They definitely don't.
In any sense. So coming back to what we were talking about, if you look at the guys at the top of the game, really almost all of them on most of their strokes have limitations. There's very few genuinely complete. When I think about a complete stroke, I'm talking about a shot that is capable of doing, basically everything. If you think like Roger Federer's forehand, for example, he can hit the ball incredibly heavy. I mean, he's capable and he's been recorded hitting Nadal-level topspin. He can also hit Del Potro-level speed. I mean, he can choose exactly what he wants to do with that ball and do anything. And that's a complete stroke. But then if I take a different shot, let's take an extreme example, like Andy Roddick's backhand, for example. He didn't have the ability to do everything. Andy Roddick was incapable of hitting a heavy topspin backhand with that stroke. It just simply was not in the cards for him. And so he had to make choices around that stroke with that limitation in place. If we look at even like Novak Djokovic's backhand, obviously a fantastic shot, absolutely fantastic shot. He can hit it cross-court. He can hit it angled. He can go deep over and over and over again. But he doesn't actually hit a heavy spin ball off that side.
Right.
And I mean, if you take Wawrinka's backhand, Stanislas' backhand is so much heavier than Djokovic's, it's not even funny. I'm not saying that Stanislas' backhand is a better shot. I mean, I personally think that it is overall. He just doesn't move as well. But right. The point is, it's just about completeness. So when you look at pro players, what they're really doing is they're managing their limitations well. The ones that are successful, the ones that maximize their potential, are the ones that are managing their limitations well and playing around the weaknesses in their game and not exposing and putting them in situations where they're trying to do stuff with a stroke that they just can't do consistently. Those are the guys that get the most out of what they have. And the girls too, because it's not limited just to men's tennis.
No, obviously not. Here's the example that I like to think of. Or this is the one that kind of is powerful to me, because there's lots of examples to use. You take a shot that I think the media or pundits or just, you know, all of us have picked on for years, was Andy Roddick's backhand. I mean, it was so much weaker than his forehand and so much weaker than his serve, right? So you say, oh, here's the glaring hole in your game is your backhand. But let's compare it to Fabrice Santoro's two-handed slice forehand. You remember that shot? Like, realistically, are you telling me that a two-handed slice forehand was a better shot than Andy's backhand? Like, Andy could slice it. He could hit topspin with it. He could hit it flat. He could certainly hit it harder than you could hit a two-handed slice.
Well, yes, but let's also... I mean, that's a tough one for you, because Centauri's slice forehand was nasty.
Yeah, because we called him the magician because he managed it so well and because he made such good choices with it. He always framed the point in a way so that he had a good chance to do whatever it was he wanted to do. He didn't play points so that he'd set it up so that, oh, now I have to hit a slice forehand passing shot, right? He framed points so that now he could hit a backhand passing shot, and guess what? That guy had a world-class backhand, right?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
If you look at Andy Roddick, I mean, he achieved more than Santoro. He got to number one in the world, yada, yada, yada. But over and over and over again, we would find Andy Roddick with Roger Federer at the net, and Andy's trying to hit a backhand pass. And guess what? That shot's not good enough to hit a backhand pass any more than Santoro could hit a slice forehand pass.
But not consistently enough to make it.
Come on, you're not going to pass Federer with slice. The best hope you have is to lob there, right?
Well, but yeah, I don't think Fed ever lost to Santoro. So
no, I don't think he did. He doesn't lose to a lot of guys.
This is also true.
But especially these days, apparently. But This is the point, right? Is, you know, we don't have to use Andy Roddick's backhand. We can compare lots of shots to it. When you look at Santoro, to me, is the guy that really jumps out, where we're saying, like, you know, this is as one-dimensional of a shot as exists, or like Steffi Graf's backhand. Like, she sliced them all. And yeah, it's a great slice, because it has to be, because she's doing the same thing every time, right? But it doesn't get much more one-dimensional than that.
Well, yeah. See, but there, like you say that, and I have a little bit of an issue, just because, I mean, when I think about Steffi Graf's slice backhand, I mean, sure, it was slice every time, but she could move that thing around the court, and she could bring it up high and play it deep down the line, a deep cross court. She could vary the speed somewhat. I mean, it wasn't that one-dimensional. I think
the only thing that's more one-dimensional is players that hit a mostly flat two-handed backhand that just doesn't have much on it, and it's hard.
But there's a lot of guys out there that play professional tennis that have that backhand.
There's a ton of guys that have that backhand, but it's much less obvious as a shot, and it's harder to point to a single one that is a universal reference. Everybody knows Steffi Graf's slice backhand, or if you go on YouTube, you know, it's going to be obvious from watching 5 minutes.
Well, here's what I would say rather instead is, look, Steffi Graf's backhand was a fantastic, phenomenal, world-class shot. It wasn't a complete shot. There were things that she could not do. I mean, she could hit over the backhand, but she didn't do it very often for a reason. It wasn't a shot she was comfortable with. there were limitations on that side, and she played and built her game around those limitations. The point of it is, coming back to this whole diagram situation, is, look, if you record your match and you map out and diagram where in the court you make errors and what direction you're hitting the ball when you do so, you can start to get a better understanding of, am I making errors that I shouldn't be making because I'm hitting the wrong shot, or is there just a problem with the shot that I need to know about? Because, look, folks, you should make more errors going down the line than hitting cross court as a general rule of thumb, right? If your technique's kind of under the norm, in the normal spectrum. But that's not true for everybody. Some people hit the ball better down the line than cross court because of the way they hit the ball. You need to know if you're that person. Because if you're that person and you keep trying to hit balls cross court, you're going to keep making errors, and vice versa. If you've got to map out where you're hitting in the court, where you're standing when you're making errors, and understand where your bad choices are coming in, you can win more matches right now without changing one speck of your technique simply by understanding where you make mistakes and where your strengths lie. And if you can do that, and then you can start to make better choices. And that's where we're leading into for the next podcast, which is having an actual understanding of what your strengths and weaknesses are. How do we then start to put that together and make a cohesive picture, a picture that looks together and makes sense, that lets you go out and play tennis with a plan that wins you more matches?
That sounds great.
I mean, I thought that's so. I like the idea of it.
I mean, we should all have answers to that question.
Yeah, so a little bit of housekeeping as we wrap up, folks. If you haven't already, please go on your podcast app, whatever you use, if it's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play, and rate this podcast. Do us a favor, because I think you'd be the first one to actually do a rating for us on iTunes. We haven't got one there yet. You can set Technical Tennis Podcast History. But it really does help us out, because I know this may come as a shock, but we do not have a massive advertising budget that we're spending on this podcast. So word of mouth is pretty much it, and that's you. So if you want us to not have a month and a half gap in the future, it helps us if you rate the podcast and do a few things to help promote us. So, you know, share it on Facebook and share it with your friends. Tell people. And get out there and rate it for us. That really does make a big difference.
Definitely. And please, again, I want to know, well, we want to know, both of us, you know, what worked, what doesn't work, what you like and what doesn't like. So email me, jacob@tacticaltennis.com.
And you can email me, glenn@tacticaltennis.com. And yeah, if you don't like the show, then don't rate us on iTunes. Just send us an email and tell us.
Yeah, please don't be a dick and be like, hey, your first rating sucks.
Please don't, you know, don't like, be annoying. Yeah.
Send us an email and tell us what we can do. I mean, we're not professional podcasters. We're professional tennis coaches. There is a difference.
Yes. Yes. And outside of that, you know, please check out the website. You can follow us also on Twitter @TacticalTennis and Instagram
@TacticalTennis as well.
And yeah, on the Instagram, you'll see pictures from all over the world that Jacob's posting from the various tournaments, so that you can get a kind of more of a behind the scenes look at some stuff from the tournaments that you don't normally get a chance to see. So that's kind of unique.
It sounds good to me. Let me know what you want me to go and find, because we kind of have to be everywhere.
Yeah. And on that note, folks, have a good one and hope to hear from you soon.
Later, guys.